Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'm Nick Ravelis, the host of UCSD-TV's Opera Talk and the Geisel Director of Education and Outreach for San Diego Opera. My passion is helping people understand opera and come to love it as much as I do. I invite the principal artistic team for each production here to the Beverly Sills Salon for a freewheeling discussion before a live audience that covers everything from the music to the motivations of the characters to the director's stage vision and sometimes even a penetrating look at a singer's career. There is never a dull moment, and it's one of the joys of my job that I get to moderate these discussions. I think you'll enjoy it too. Good evening, everybody, and thank you very much for being here for our Stars in the Salon event, our Artists' Roundtable concerning Charles Gounod's Faust, an opera that we haven't seen in a little while, so it'll be good to sort of dig into it and talk about this fascinating subject of this wonderful opera. Let me introduce, first of all, my panel sitting right next to me and coming back from last season, having been Juliette in Gounod's other wonderful opera, Eileen Pérez, soprano. Obviously, she will be singing the role of Marguerite. Next to her is our tenor, most recently from the Italian tenor in Rosencavalier and last year's Romeo, Stephen Costello, singing the role of Faust. And then our bass baritone in playing the role that I think is the most fun in Faust, of course, Mephistopheles, last was with us in season 2009 as Scarpia in Tosca, Greer Grimsley. And next to him, of course, our resident conductor, she's been here forever.
Thank you, Nick.
But just from last season, having conducted a brilliant La Boheme, Karen Keltner. Also from the cast of Romeo last year. So we've got a lot to talk about in terms of Gounod and these two operas, Romeo as well as Faust, our trouser role, the role of Ciabel, mezzo-soprano Sarah Castle. And finally, last with us, our stage director and designer of the production of Don Pasquale by Donizetti, which we just thoroughly, thoroughly loved and is coming back next season. That was season 2002. We haven't seen him since, so it's good to welcome back David Gately. I think I want to, first of all, open it up to all of you. And one of the things that's sort of a mystery to me about Faust is the fact that it not virtually disappeared, but there was a period of maybe 30 years there, pretty recently, that it simply wasn't produced that often. And Romeo et Juliet seemed to be on ascendance, and Faust seemed to be in a descending path. Why do you think that was? I mean, after all, it was the most popular opera in the repertoire for a very, very long time. I would almost say from its premiere in 1859 right up into the 50s. What do you think it was that sort of stopped it in its tracks?
Wow.
Maestro.
Oh, thanks a lot, folks. Nick and I have already talked about this. I think things go through seasons and fads. And I think people actually, because for many, many years, Faust graced every opera stage in this country, in Europe. And I think there was a time at which people either by imagination or maybe by taste just said, I see. I've had enough. And it just fell out of favor. Things do that, certainly. And I think it's coming back into favor. And I think that style, because I think there was a certain degree of snobism about Gounod, maybe not about Gounod, let's not say Gounod, but that kind of style that we wanted things more avant-garde. It certainly was around the time when people were exploring new ways of expressing anything musically. And so anything that was quite beautiful or tonal or, you know, tasteful maybe was, and I'm being facetious to a degree, but I really do think there are ups and downs just like everything we experience in life. So I'd be happy to hear from my dear mute colleagues on this.
Well, I think that maybe French opera kind of went out of fashion a little bit because people considered it frivolous and
shallow,
exactly. I don't think it is. I actually happen to be a big fan of French opera. I haven't done a lot of it. As a matter of fact, this is only my second Faust. The last one was in 1982. So I haven't done a lot of it. I've only done Romeo and Juliet once. So I haven't done a lot of French opera. But I think it kind of went out of fashion for a while.
Hmm. How about casting it? Do you think that there was a problem of finding people who could sing these roles well?
Probably a problem with people who knew people who could sing these roles. There shouldn't have been a problem in casting it.
No, there shouldn't have been. I mean, it's pretty much standard repertoire.
Yeah.
And what you learn in music school, and I can't pretend to know why people didn't program it, but I'm a big fan of French opera as well, having grown up in New Orleans. I think people just did think of it as frivolous and forgot that also French opera could be more than what it had been, which up until the 50s, that's what people, it was basically stand and sing for everything. And when there was this big move to really do opera as what opera is, which is drama and music together, the French repertoire sort of got left behind. And now I think it's people realize that shouldn't have happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, a wonderful case in point is the Don Quixote that we did a few seasons back.
Who had seen or heard of that?
Yeah, and it turned out to be the sleeper hit of the year. I mean, it's a wonderful dramatic piece.
You know, Nick, I found, not in preparation for this, but when I was reading about Gounod, this wonderful quote from Gounod, and I think it might also shed some light on this, because what he says here is basically what fell out of fashion in all the arts, I think. And he said, Gounod himself said, France is essentially the country of precision, neatness, and taste. C'est-à-dire, or that's to say, the opposite of excess, pretentiousness, disproportion, and long-windedness. I mean, you can take that. It definitely shows a prejudice, but it certainly outlines what kind of describes. And for that very reason, maybe people were just a little. It wasn't flashy enough. Yeah.
They thought it was kind of artificial too. There was always a big ballet that was. It was optional, but you know, there's piles of ballet music in Faust, which no one ever hears unless they listen to a recording. That's never performed or rarely performed. And that was kind of a tradition in French opera. It was kind of weighted down with a lot of traditions that I think that we can ignore a little bit now as we explore them as pieces of theater, like Greer said. So I think we can go much farther with French opera.
Well, you know, actually that's one of the questions that I was going to ask a little later, but why don't we get into it now? And if I can find it... Well, but yeah, I can easily remember it. The fact is that there's a lot of music in Faust that we never hear because it's usually cut. And certainly there's the ballet, which has, I believe, 4 or 5 movements. And if you heard the first few bars of every movement, you would recognize that music. It is not unrecognizable music at all. But it also includes the Walpurgis Nacht scene, a wonderful drinking song for the tenor. Let's start with David and then just go down the line. Do we miss much not having all of that music in that scene?
It's 3.5 hours long, even as it is.
So you miss it.
I don't think we miss it at all. We're doing a lot more of it than is often done. I mean, we're doing the spinning scene with these two lovely ladies. That's not always done.
Mm-hmm.
So we are actually doing more of it than usual. But no, I think that they were really long-winded, and I think it was Stephen who came up to me last night and told me about three other pieces that were in the original version that they had to cut out because it was too long. I can't imagine three more pieces in this. Stephen, what were they?
I think Gounod had written a... we talked about it in your office. He had written a trio for Faust, Cybele, and Wagner, and also a duet for Marguerite and Valentin. And also, I believe it was three sonnets for a friend of Marguerite. Including also the ballet. And actually, when he showed up for the first week of rehearsal, they had told him that it was way too long and he needs to cut it. So that's what went. And in its place went the Soldier's Chorus.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that he would have gotten the feedback that it was way too long in the era of Meyerbeer when, you know... when those operas were a good 5 or 6 hours long, and the only limitation was that everybody had to get out of the opera house so that they could get to the last train going to the suburbs.
I just sat through one of his operas in New York, and yeah, I missed the last train.
Really, it's crazy. But anybody else have anything to say about the missing music? I mean, is there anything that...
I found out that Greer has performed Faust before with in Act 3, a reordering of the parts. Right?
Oh, yeah.
We're doing a different
order of things.
So there's that, too, besides music that's unheard being cut again and other music that's cut being heard here. We're actually doing it in the printed order the show.
I think the reorganization, the one that we often had done before, which was not immediately the church scene, but was done when it went to Italy. And changed around.
What happened was Gounod had actually originally written it with the church scene after the death of Valentin. And when the first premiere came, I guess the head of the opera company...
Théâtre Lyrique.
Yeah, he wanted it the other way around. I don't know why, but it made him change it, as well as cut the opera. I mean, so there has to be a reason, I guess, why.
We've done it here, we've done it in the order you're speaking about, Eileen, and so this is the first time we've done it in the printed order here.
The intendant of the Lyrique, who was responsible for Faust, also. Went to the Opéra Comique and was responsible for Roméo et Juliette as well. Juliette was written, as a matter of fact, for his wife. I don't think Marguerite was written for her. I'm not even sure that they were married at that point, but Leon Carvalho, I suspect that an awful lot of this was due to him and his dramatic sensibilities and what he knew would work on stage and what would not in Paris at that time. So it may be this is why. But it is rather interesting that with a lot of the basic French repertoire, there are all these questions of what should be done when, missing music, scene order. I mean, let's talk about Hoffmann. Or Carmen even.
Yeah. Bag of worms.
Yeah.
Every French piece I know is a huge puzzle when you start out to decide what version you're going to use, what order you're going to. I don't know whether that's from the mentality itself, but you can bet that the orchestra parts are usually in disarray.
And disintegrating,
yes. So it's always a quandary, I think.
Unlike the Germans.
Sometimes the source of an opera is so far removed from its libretto that it doesn't necessarily make sense for a director or a designer or a singer to go to the source to look for inspiration or to help inform the performance. In this case, the source, of course, is Goethe, very serious verse play in German, one of the great monuments of Western literature, and you can capitalize both of those words. Have any of you read the Goethe recently? And if you did, was it helpful? And how?
I tried. I was in Berlin, and I went to Dussmann and picked up the play and started. And it's not so much the archaic language. The German is archaic, but we're used to it, dealing with the literature that we sing, you know, in Lieder and the poetry that I had been studying in university. So it's not the language, it's just that it doesn't get to the good part for a long time. And, you know, the good part to me, of course, has to do with Marguerite or Gretchen. And, you know, once... Then I saw, at the same time I was in Berlin, they were doing the play on one of the stages, and of course what's wonderful about, you know, being in Europe is that they televise these plays on a local channel, and I was watching a play's production where Marguerite is played by 14 women, and they're all saying her lines at the same time. So I was immediately distracted from the novel and... went to the watching this play being performed, and I thought, you know, I should probably set that on my long-term delve into with a scholar that might be able to guide me through it.
Your bucket list.
And sort of just go back to the French, and even because ultimately we can do wonderful research and find out the just great details about the character. And then you come to the music, and in the music, there's a certain expression already in that score that tells you what emotional state the character is in, and already the librettist has chosen the words very carefully, and you just have to say, oh, okay, well, I got to play this way now, because it'll just look like I don't know what I'm doing or saying if I play it another way.
And also that not only the music and the libretto, but the director that you work with is going to have their view of it as well. So it's good to be informed about what you might think about it, but not to be too fixed in your ideas, because otherwise it's not very helpful to a director if we turn up and go, no, this is the way I do it. You know, it's a process that we all go through together and develop how we all feel about it. So a certain amount of research and a certain amount of openness, I think, is called for.
Yeah, and I guess it doesn't make a whole lot of... It's not helpful to know that Goethe has Mephistopheles appear first as a poodle.
Well... You know, I think a much underestimated dog. But you know, many years ago, I did go to the Goethe when I was doing my first Mephistopheles, and you just sort of, with some things, you just sort of take it as a starting point, and then you see what the composer did. Much more interesting was researching Dr. Faustus himself, you know, and the things that were attributed to him. And he was a wild man, so, you know, it was as if he would just say things and people would believe him, no matter how crazy they were. You know, like, as he claimed that the devil was his brother-in-law. And people went, okay, and then gave him a wide berth, you know. So it was a time that you could say anything you wanted and people would believe you.
David, was the Goethe ever helpful to you at all when the first time that you directed Faust?
I never read it. You know,
I like your honesty.
No, I had to be terribly honest, because if I started faking it, you'd all know. You know, once again, I use source material a lot of the times. I didn't in this particular case. It was much more important for me to delve in and find out what's actually in the opera. Mm. And as Eileen said, those words could have come out of my mouth. I mean, the music tells you so much about what's going on with those characters that may or may not have been in the Goethe. And that's where you kind of have to start, with the words and the music that are actually there in front of you. Mm-hmm. So, and that's often the way I'll do it. I look at the piece first and then think, oh, maybe I need to research this a little bit and find out what the background of this is. But I didn't. I'm not fluent in any way in German. It would have been torture in every possible level for me to try to read that play.
I don't want to spend too much time on the historical thing. We'll move on to music and singing, but it's interesting simply to note that, like Carmen, the very first production of Faust was had spoken dialogue, mm-hmm. and these were all separate numbers. It was essentially a number opera. It would be interesting to hear either a recording or see it done that way, if one could even hope to dig up the dialogue. It might even not be the same as the recitatives that we've got, but it's interesting to even think that it had spoken dialogue at one point. It's strange to me.
I was just asked to learn the dialogue in German for a production in Hamburg. And I think I didn't even respond to that email, really. But I think unanimously the rest of the cast said, I'm sorry, we only know it in French, and we're doing so. Thankfully, I won't have to learn that.
That's good. That's good. Since we did Romeo and Juliet last season, it's sort of tempting to compare and contrast the two pieces, especially since Gounod worked with the same librettists for both works, Jules Barbier and Michel Carré. Karen, how do these two operas, separated by nearly a decade, compare in terms of orchestration? Do you see growth in Gounod's work in these two pieces?
Romeo was after.
Yeah, exactly.
And interestingly enough, even though Nick and I have often discussed how much I do adore the music of Romeo, I find coming back to Faust a more fertile score in terms of variety of musical expression. I think there's the king of Tulé. With that modal flavor, you have the dance, the waltz, which is just soaring, the big, magnificent choral, a lot of choral work in this piece, and I think that highly reflects Gounod's penchant for choral music. I was interested to find out that he's, in England, more known for his choral music, or at the time he was working, much more renowned for his choral music than for any of his operas, and had quite a lucrative career there as a choral composer. So we have the soldiers' chorus, we have those glorious, even offstage interjection choruses, which the chorus enjoys singing because it's prolonged singing and it's feel-good singing. It makes vocal sense to them. Then we have all this business with the devil. We have the wonderful lyricism which Faust and Marguerite express at different times, and the punctuation of the orchestra. It's a little bit more lively. It's a little bit more, again, I use the word varied, but more variety of expression of mood and temperament, I think. Why don't we ask our two Romeo folks here what they feel?
You go ahead. No, I don't. I think as you were speaking, I was thinking of another aspect, so I don't recall the original statement. But I was going to say how supposedly in this time, really the creation of the lyric soprano was happening with this score, even as Juliet. But I think Marguerite, just the way it lies, I was wondering if you know, like, in the repertoire of the lyric mezzo, is there a similarity with this French music, or do you find, because I find it's really unique to finally have some repertoire that's not always sailing above C or you know, just hang time up there with florid runs. Marguerite is more lyric, and by lyric I mean it's closer in tessitura to a natural speaking voice. And it's not as bombastically florid. So, but that's what I was thinking while you were saying.
I think that the same is
the musical
true
growth,
for the mezzo of it. Interestingly enough, in the score, Siebel is actually given as soprano. So for me, I mean, of course, we tend to do it with mezzo-sopranos because of it being a trouser role, so it's almost more a tradition than anything. The vocal tessitura is really quite similar to the Marguerite in some ways, I mean, obviously a little lower. But for me, it's an example of what my teacher told me at music college, which was, I said to him, am I a soprano, am I a mezzo? He said, you're a female voice. And that is demonstrated for me by this very much. They can call it a soprano. They just mean a female who's appropriate for singing it. It's not particularly low. It's not particularly high. So that, again, similar to the speaking voice, it makes it comfortable is the wrong word because it's more interesting than comfortable, but you can think very much about the lyricism then and not just how you're going to deal with a florid coloratura or, you know.
Stephen, what about the difference between the two male roles, between Faust and Romeo?
For me, I think it was a progression of how Gounod ended up writing for the tenor, because if you listen to Faust is a lot more lyrical, and oftentimes, I mean, if you go back to the older recordings, listen to like George Steele, there's a lot of falsetto that's incorporated in a lot of the high notes that they would sing in the older recordings of Faust, as opposed to Romeo and Juliet, where Romeo seems more. It starts out lyric, but it's also gets very dramatic towards the end, and it also sounds more of an Italian way of singing as opposed to the French Faust, the French version of a tenor, I guess, in Faust. And Romeo is definitely more demanding, but I think if you listen to like the bedroom scene, for an example, in Romeo and Juliet, between Romeo and Juliet, it's just very very Italian. It's very big. It's very grand. And then you have the duet between Marguerite and Faust, which is beautiful as it is, but it's not as grand as the duet in Romeo and Juliet. It's very singing through your middle voice most of the time, and more delicate, I'd say. But if you listen to the Romeo and Juliet, it's more grand, but it's also delicate in a way that he expresses the way that the two lovers are you know, coming together for the first time after marriage, and it's completely different.
Mm. Sarah, do you ever get to sing a female role? Now, because I was looking at your bio today, and I find this fascinating. Niklaus, Marco Polo by Tan Dunn, Cherubino, Stefano, Siebel, Hansel, Idamante, Orlovsky. You're really something of a specialist in that area. Is there a dream role for you that's a female role that you haven't had an opportunity to sing yet that we might be able to stage for you sometime?
Here's my opportunity. Who's listening to this?
Get your order
in. Yeah. Absolutely. I'd like to. It's funny, actually. You seem to have done more research into this than I have. I keep meaning to actually do a tally of how many roles, because people ask me this, and I often say more than 50% of the time, because that's what it feels to me. I do men or boys. I mean, even within that, there is quite a range. So it's not like, you know, in this I'm being a young man or an old boy, depending. We haven't discussed the age, but, you know, I'm too young to be going off to battle. So maybe I'm 14 or 15. I'm old enough to be starting to fall in love. And that's very much the same with Stefano and with Cherubino. But, of course, if I'm doing Hansel and Hansel and Gretel, he's maybe six or yeah. something. And then there are all of the Handel heroes, which if they choose to cast that with a mezzo-soprano rather than a countertenor, then I'm being Theseus or, you know, somebody older. So there is quite a variety, even within the trouser roles. People ask me if it feels strange doing those roles, and really I am so much more used to doing it that what feels strange is when I have to wear heels and a skirt on stage, because then I'm not really quite sure how to walk. And I did the Marchesa Melibea in Rossini's Il Viaggio a Reims, and I had this lovely little Chanel suit and these court shoes, and I really didn't know how to sit because I'm so used to just plonking myself down with my knees apart. And so oddly enough, it's actually the other way around. But yeah, some of the Rossini heroines, I'm pleased when I get a chance to do them. So I've done a Rosina. Isabella would be quite fun. And... yeah, I mean, I love the challenge, actually, of doing a female role. So, yeah.
That's interesting. Stephen, tell us a little bit about what your schedule has been like. I mentioned earlier that you sang the Italian tenor in our Rosenkavalier production, which just closed this past Tuesday night. And so you were singing, well, first of all, rehearsing Rosenkavalier and then singing the role, and then... going into rehearsals for Faust.
Yeah, my schedule has been hell. Excuse me.
Tell us a little bit about that.
It actually started last year when I was here for Romeo and Juliet. Because after Romeo and Juliet, I went right to Dallas to jump into to start Moby Dick, which is a world premiere opera, which took 7 weeks. And then from Moby Dick, I went right to Berlin to sing Bohème. And then from Bohème, I jumped into rehearsal in Bohème in Cincinnati. And then from the Bohème rehearsal in Cincinnati, or after the last performance anyway, I went right to Salzburg to start Romeo. And then I got a call when I was in Salzburg, can I leave Salzburg a week early to come to Vienna to sing Bohème, which I did. And then I had a week off, 2 weeks off, and then I went to Dallas to sing Anna Bolena. And then from Dallas, I think I got a couple weeks there. And then I did two concerts followed by... followed by, what did I do in January? I don't even remember. No, started Romeo and Juliet in Philadelphia. And then did two recitals for the first time right after that. And then as soon as I finished them, I came right here. And then I started Rosenkavalier. I've been writing a column for the San Diego Union-Tribune. And actually, right after the last performance of this, I fly to Glyndebourne for 3 months to do Elysier throughout the summer. And then when I finish there, I go right to New York to start Anna Bolena at the Met.
And it's, yeah, so I guess I what
think,
you're saying
I don't think
is...
I'm ever going to be home. You know, but luckily, you know, my wife will be with me some of the, well, at least for the next 2 weeks. But it's been a really busy schedule.
But I guess what you're saying is that you're used to being busy, so
well,
it's
I'd
probably
be
working
than
so
unemployed. I mean, but yeah, I mean, it's kind of expected, especially being young singers. You kind of have to take the opportunities as they come up, and then when you get a little more seasoned and have made your debuts in the houses that you want to sing in, you can then pick and choose what you want to do and start taking time off from there. Because, you know, the worst part about being a young singer is if you're not singing for maybe 3 or 4 months, people forget about you.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's really important to just, you know, keep going and keep the momentum going until you really establish yourself in the business.
Yeah. Greer, the bass baritone, is often called upon to sing the baddies in the opera repertoire, including Mephistopheles, Scarpia, Pizarro, Telramund, the three Hoffman villains, all of which you've done. Are there any other villains that you'd like to play, but you haven't gotten around to?
Well, he's not really a villain, but a faulted human being, and that's Blitch and Susanna. I've never gotten to do that, that's and amazing. I would love to do that. You know, anything that has that I find all those characters very interesting. So, yeah, Blitch would be is one of the ones that I've been looking to do.
And I'd love to hear you do that. That would be exciting. Any comic roles that you would like to do?
Well, I'm looking forward to down the road, yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. I would love to do, you know, Italian Girl.
Mm-hmm.
That would be fun. But I think, well, David... Well, we didn't do anything comedic together.
No, we've only done Tosca, but
we only
I have to
tell
you, he's darn funny. He could do any of yeah. those funny guys.
Yeah. So I'm saving them for later.
Great.
Yeah.
I hope I'm not retired by then.
And why, let's get into that just a little bit. Why would you save them for later?
Well, the thing is why not... people have, and not so much audience, but people who hire have a little problem with seeing you. If you do a Basilio, and you're also mm-hmm. doing Votan, they can't put the two together.
Mm-hmm. You know, at least not anymore.
Yeah, and I think it's you just sort of have to plan it that way. You sort of look at there's a season for your roles, and you know right now I'm in the season of doing Votans and mm-hmm. and all of the villains. Demons and gods, and then sort of as I age into my career, you know, to start maybe adding these other roles mm-hmm. along the way.
Mm-hmm. I often find myself, this is for everybody, reading a book or a newspaper article, even magazine article, or seeing a movie, and thinking, that property has operatic possibilities. Someone should write an opera based on it. And I'm sure you've all probably had the same or similar ideas. Of what you've seen or read recently, is there anything that stands out for you as something that would make great musical theater? And what's the role that you would like to sing? This is sort of a Met matinee question, I know, but... It just sort of struck me today that it would be kind of fun to see if any of you have thought of that. Let's start with Eileen. Okay. Put you on the spot.
Well, look,
and pull up that microphone.
I know this comes with judgment as I say it, I know, but Charlie Sheen and 2 and a Half Men and just maybe, you know, they did the opera, Anna Nicole Smith, so I'd love them to maybe capsulize Charlie Sheen, but... I don't know if the audience could take it, and I don't know that I want to see it. You know what I mean? So.
Well, but you couldn't play Charlie. Well, perhaps you could.
It could be but, a new pants
would you,
role.
Would you want to be one of the two goddesses? Is that?
Oh, no. Yeah. trouble.
Stephen?
You know, I haven't really thought of it, but, you know, it's funny that you asked that. My teacher once said to me after, he said, you know, somebody should write an opera for you about Charlie Chaplin. And I looked at him and said, you mean the silent film star? And he said, yeah, it'd be great. I don't think you ever got it. I mean,
Greer?
There was a wonderful, I can't even remember the author, but there was a wonderful novel about World War II, and it was set in, it was called Snow Falling on Cedars.
Oh, yes, yes.
And
yes.
I thought that would make a wonderful opera, and it's one of the few books that actually made me cry when I read it, and I actually no, thank you, I was actually talking to the book as I was reading it, you know. No, don't do that, no. But I thought that would be there was something very operatic about the story that I thought would happen.
Was there a role in it for you?
I don't know, but I just thought that it would make a wonderful either music theater or opera.
Mm. Karen?
I don't sing. I could pass, but I will say something. Ian and I have, in fact, I believe it may have been Ian's original idea, but we've been talking about it. And with the very recent and sad death of Daniel Catan, it came up again because I believe Ian had spoken to him about wanting to do an opera on Like Water for Chocolate. Mm. And I think that has great possibilities. It could be another French opera. Yes. But I would not like to sing any role in it.
But I'm sure you'd like to conduct it.
I would like that, yes.
Depending on who the composer is. Sarah?
It's not something I thought of recently, but actually when you ask the question, my mind goes to various children's books because I have two young children. And thinking about operas like The Cunning Little Vixen by Janáček, where we all play animals, I had such fun being a fox in that. So there's so many lovely children's books where, you know, we could all be the animals, you know, or, you know, Roald Dahl stories would always make brilliant operas, I think, and maybe with a slight push for, you know, a young audience, because it's always so wonderful to try and get younger people getting really, really interested in the theatre.
Mm. David?
I was a couple years ago in really, really, really early talks with a composer about making an opera of A Confederacy of Dunces.
Oh, perfect. Yeah.
It's not possible because the rights are tied up. Paramount Studios bought it for John Candy, and they still own the rights, and they're not letting them go. So that project kind of went by the wayside. But it's just rife with possibilities, and the leading character is operatic in a comic and in a larger than life sort of way. He'd be a great opera.
A great book.
Yeah, great book.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. About careers now, Eileen, I heard just briefly a bit of a story about you singing Violetta in Japan. That comes with a sort of a very interesting story. Could you relate that to us? You stepped in last minute, last second kind of thing.
I was brought along on to the tour to Japan with Royal Opera House, and they hadn't been in Japan. I think the first tour was in 1979, and they hadn't been back for 10 years. And so this is, you know, one of the... I was very happy and excited to go on this trip. And I was engaged to cover the roles of Manon in Massenet's Manon, the Laurent Pelly production that was just premiered at Royal Opera House, and also the La Traviata, and which is a big undertaking. And it was, you know, I was looking at it as the possibility of learning the role of Manon with Maestro Pappano, and also, you know, performing... even rehearsing Violetta with him as well, because you always grow in those circumstances. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm off to Japan, and I'm sitting in the audience watching the opening night, and the opening night ceremonies were really beautiful because, again, it's the big opening of the tour, and the Japanese were very thrilled to have Covent Garden visiting, and, you know, as... they're just supremely formal and so elegant in all of their ways. And so this, you know, the La Traviata, the downbeat happened, and I'm sitting in the audience, and the intermission, the curtain comes down on the act one, and I was told, go backstage. And I thought, I wonder why, because everything seemed to be going well. And it turned out my colleague had a severe allergic reaction to something. And in a matter of minutes, the wardrobe team and makeup, you know, my hair, I have long hair, so it was already kind of up. And they just put me in the dress, which, you know, they brought on tour. Of course, they've measured me because I'm the cover. And I went on, and I made, that was my company debut, and also my debut in Tokyo. So it was very, it was really special to go, I mean, being on call for any kind of emergency situation is a stressful thing, mostly because you're balancing the emotions of course I would love to go on, but of course I don't want to see anybody in despair, or, you know, you don't wish for people to be indisposed. You go thinking you're going to learn, be a part of the experience, and should the situation arise where you have to go on, you do your very best and see what happens at the end. Hopefully the audience would be appreciative. Well, they were so appreciative, and that was one of the biggest triumphs, I guess, in my little career. And it was also a wonderful example of being a part of a company where I think I've mentioned this before, and I know my colleagues notice when they go to theaters. You are part of the show, and you're engaged, and you're invited. But there is that stress, okay, now you have to perform, and of course you hope for further invitations. Something you don't expect, and which is a nice surprise, is when you find this great camaraderie among your colleagues and among the artistic staff, and you feel this big family connection. And so that's kind of what that's... Beyond what happened in the performance, beyond what happened in light of all the situations, I think it was wonderful to be embraced with the orchestra and the backstage crew and the members and also the audience in Japan.
That's exciting.
It was very special.
That's a great story. David, one final question, and that is, I'm very curious because the libretto doesn't give us much of a clue at the end of this particular opera. What happens to Faust? What happens to Faust?
Well, the way we're playing it is that he goes off with the devil, and not happily. But Marguerite is saved. And in this production, Faust is damned and is being dragged off at the end by Mephistopheles to fulfill the contract that he signed at the beginning.
So, Stephen, how do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, I like it. I mean, I really enjoy working with David, and I really like his ideas. And if you haven't got him in for a story, you know, David actually directed me in my first opera ever, which was Don Curzio in Marriage of Figaro with Eileen. And then in my second year, he gave me my first job, my first professional job, singing Bohème in Fort Worth Opera. And then David has also directed my first run of Lucia's. And then he's now directing my first Faust. So, I mean, you know, I stand by David Gately. You know, no, but, you know, I like it, especially the way we have it staged and the way that David has it as Faust not really wanting to go, but has no choice because of what he signed in the beginning. And it's really effective. It's really nice.
Let's take some questions from the audience. If anybody has any questions, be happy to entertain those.
I hope you don't mind me asking a question, a very personal question of all of you. But since you're professionals in opera, do you ever just go to the opera?
Go.
I always say that I don't. because it's my job, not my hobby. But my exception to that, I have two exceptions to that. If I'm at a new opera house that I've not sung at before and there's something that I can see, it's really great to be in the auditorium and picture myself from the other side and hear the acoustic. Not that I will sing in any different way, but it's just a sort of preparation for it. And the other exception is that I'll go to see friends sing, just like I'll go to see them if they're, you know, playing basketball or a tennis match or whatever. I go to support friends. And then I always find that I actually quite like listening to opera. It sneaks up on me, but actually I do quite like it.
Anyone else would like to answer that? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I really wasn't introduced to opera until I was a junior in high school. So once I got into music school, I was in the music library all the time as much as I could be. And I love to go. I love seeing my friends, as you know, and you know, you can learn a lot just by watching as well.
I live in Seattle, and I try to see as much I can of Greer. He's a big star in Seattle. And interestingly, he does the ring cycle during the summer, and I'm never there in the summer, so I've never seen his Votons, but I've seen a number of his other, we were just talking about this the other night, of his Wagner characters. I don't often go to the opera because it feels too much like work, but if it's a piece I want to see, if it's something that I didn't, you know, haven't seen before, I'll definitely go. And to see friends, it's just exactly the same.
I love to go, especially when I know someone who's singing in the show. It's quite magical to be on that side. I don't think I'll ever 100% know what it's like to just be a subjective audience member, being that it's so related to what I do, and I'm thinking, and I'm, you know, on, you know, giving all the good vibes out to the performers, hoping and wishing them all the best. So it's not really a relaxing event, but it's wonderful to be swept away by new music. And it happened here when I went to opening night of Rosenkavalier, and it was fantastic to hear all the, you know, the wonderful artists and the orchestra and the piece. It was just sublime. So it was wonderful.
Stephen,
I go mostly when I'm performing in an opera house. And I go for many things. One, because, you know, it's what I do. I like watching opera. But you also go to hear different singers, people you've never heard of before. Because often in this business, we get contracts that are, you know, 4 or 5 years in advance, and with some people you've never heard of. And it's also nice to just go and watch them and see what they do and know the, and meet the people that you're going to be working with. And also see people that are like the big stars of today and why they're on stage, why they're considered big stars, you know. Just learn from watching different people. And it's enjoyable for me, so I go a lot.
Any other questions?
This is for Stephen. After your 5 minutes in Rosenkavalier, do you just go home?
Absolutely. I walked right off the stage into my dressing room, makeup off, went to Johnny Brown's, had a burger, walked home. And it was actually the, you know, the only night I actually had to stay was opening night to take, you know, or opening day anyway, to take a bow, and it was exhausting. I mean, because I can't watch the show and I can't get fully out of costume, and I have to leave my makeup on. So, you know, you're just sitting around backstage in a dressing room that's like that I've shared with 6 other people, and it's cold. And, you know, you're hearing the opera through this little speaker. I mean, it's horrendous. So, I mean, you end up going home the next day. I mean, what did we do after? I think I slept the next day. And my role wasn't that big. It was just I was so tired from sitting around listening to everybody else work. So I had asked. I said, can I just go home after it's over? So that's exactly what I did.
Well, this has been really fun. And I want to thank the entire panel for being here this evening and discussing not only their roles but a little bit about their careers. It's exciting to sort of get an inside look, isn't it, at what's going on, particularly a production like this. And it is a beautiful production. I think we've got a lot to look forward to. So thank you, panel, and we'll see all of you at the opera.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.